So you see a role for a professor of medicine as being someone who knows a lot about general medicine.
That's it.
Would also be a good family doctor.
Must be a good family doctor.
Yes, yes.
That's what we're missing so much.
Yes.
They don't know how to talk to patients. You see, a family doctor's real good is that he listens to people and he's considerate of them, and they're frightened. They come to him as something that may be nothing at all, and they give up time to explain that it's not as... See, others are so hurried, they say, oh, just take that and you'll be away, and away they go, and you get no satisfaction. That's what's going on in a lot of the departments now. They're too busy. They come and get their ears or their skins. As the one sister in the skin ward told me, they come in, their diagnosis is so obvious, it's probably a wart or something. They diagnose it as they come through the door, and as they pass the consultant, he gives them a prescription, they're out through the other door.
Yes.
Well, they may have come from Geller Shields. Now, what they really want is not to know how to treat a wart. They want to know, well, what is a wart? Why have I got a wart? Will it come back to me? You see? Is it a serious thing?
Yes.
Well, that means giving up a few minutes' talk, but they're so busy, they're so queues of people waiting, that they don't do that. They're not doctors at all.
Yes. Perhaps part of this is because general practitioners often refer patients now rather than treat them themselves.
Well, they do, but still... that's perfectly true. The general practitioners ought to do more than they do, and they probably do more. There are courses now in all these skins and eyes
and so on. Yes.
They probably do, but they are very busy too, you know.
Yes.
So they would be their damn sight well, too well paid. Do you know what they pay a general practitioner? An average of $8,600 a year and $3,500 allowances free of tax.
Yes.
Well, that's much more than most of the specialists are getting.
Oh, yes.
So that's a damn disgrace. Just a piece of blackmail by the British Medical Association, all it is.
Well, these are strong words.
Absolutely. We're just as bad as the dockers now.
Well, certainly the general practitioners for a long time were very much undervalued.
Oh,
and
yes,
felt very much out of
that's
things.
It. We've gone swung from one end to the other.
We've swung.
They worked far too long hours and far too hard. The most conscientious men. They've gone the other extreme. They're not the same thing at all. Now, a person in my old age, I pay a fee to a doctor who's a friend of mine, and I'm a national health insurance patient. Now, people like Lindsay Madame, who's a really good man, he feels that chap should come in periodically and say, "How are you?" when I'm over 80.
Mm.
But then he never does that. If he comes and sees my wife and gives her a prescription because she's got a cough and won't get back, he might come back once, but if she's not better, he mightn't come back again. Now, the old days, the man would come in 3 or 4 times, even if it's only for 4 minutes. Are you better? Are you not better? And so on. I don't know what's gone wrong with the profession.
It's a change in manners, perhaps.
That's just awful.
Yes.
I think it's terrible.
Yes. We've covered a great deal of ground. During your time as Professor of Medicine in Edinburgh, would you like to say just a little about what are the main changes you've seen from the time of your appointment to the time of your retirement?
Well, the main changes, the educational changes, were made really by me. I don't suppose you remember this, but when I came back to Edinburgh afterwards, I arranged a timetable in consultation with the professors of surgery and pathology and bacteriology, in which, when I was lecturing on typhoid fever on March the 2nd, I could rely on the bacteriologist doing the bacteriology of the typhosis during that week, and the pathologist would be doing the bowel changes and so forth, and the surgeons would be talking about when they burst and so forth. And I did that very carefully and had a huge list of case histories and photographs, thousands of them. They would give them. I don't know what Donald's done with them. Had a great big lecture room up above that the medicine department where we laid out every week, which illustrated all aspects of these cases.
Yes.
Now, Robson told me that when this committee was meeting, they went over that, and he still taught. That was a very good method of teaching medicine, a coordinated course, and that he was sorry they're not going on with it. I still think it's the right way to teach it.
It was also worked quite efficiently because only a few people were involved in the coordination.
That's right.
Whereas now there's about 5 committees involved. It's become an enormous exercise.
Awful.
Yes. Yes. Good.
I would certainly say that system that I inaugurated was couldn't be improved on from the point of view. If you're going to have systematic lectures at all, you may say you shouldn't have any systematic lectures. Why have a systematic lecture? Why not buy the book of Principles and Practice of Medicine and have none?
You've edited and prepared some very successful books. And one of these was the Principles and Practice of Medicine. And the other one was a book with Sir Derek Dunlop and Sir John McNee on therapeutics.
Yes, and treatment, yes.
What gave you the idea of producing a book like that on therapeutics?
Well,
there must have been many others on the market at the time.
Well, there were, and they were so bad that Derek Dunlop, who was the same sort of age as myself, younger even, had just been made professor of therapeutics, and he phoned me up to come down from Aberdeen to see him. And we looked at various books, and it was full of these sort of wretched statements, like vaccines may be of value, arsenic sometimes helps, and that sort of rot like that, that had gone on for years and years, and we wanted a much more positive approach to what can be done and what cannot be done, and how it works. And we were so disgusted at the books that we decided to write a new book on therapeutics. McNee was nothing to do with it this time. But Dunlop and I decided that it would be a Scottish book, and therefore we'd need to get people who wrote in it from the 4 Scottish universities. And then it seemed quite reasonable that McNee, who was much more senior and very well known for his research, should be asked to join us as editors. That's how he came into it. He had nothing to do with the idea of it. And as I've told you, he did nothing really to write it. He considered himself right beyond our ken, you know. He was too high up to be bothered with that routine work.
He was very well known for his work on the reticuloendothelial system with Aschoff.
Very well known.
Tell me, did you get to know him at all well? Did you know him?
Yes, I knew him for 30 years.
Yes.
We always were perfectly friendly, except on the one occasion when I wrote and told him to resign, furious with me. But he reported me to Lord Dawson of Penn, though what that good could do, I can't tell you. But we remained quite good friends, except that he was quite useless. He didn't think that he was too far above us to be bothered with reading proofs or writing anything.
But he was happy to have his name on the book.
That's what annoyed me, because that's exactly what I wrote in the letter to him, that if this book is a failure, you'll get the blame, and you're not to blame because you haven't done anything, and if it's a success, you'll get the credit, and you shouldn't get the credit because you haven't done anything either. That's exactly what the row was about. It didn't make the slightest difference to him. We all continued to be quite friendly, and he continued to do nothing.
Well, I remember him as a teacher, as a silvery-haired, very distinguished-looking man.
Very distinguished.
And he was a very good lecturer. And then he became an admiral in the Navy. Yes.
Well,
very famous, and I'm sure it was a great privilege to know him.
Oh, well, he used to always come to see Dunlop and me in his admiral's uniform and never came anything else and told us the most ridiculous things about himself. He had no sense of humour, that was the trouble. I mean, fancy telling a person like me that when he comes on board, they pipe me on, and when they want a doctor, they ask for Dr. McNee, not Admiral McNee. I mean, fancy telling a story like that to a rut, you know. He had no sense of humour. But, you know, I don't think he wasn't a nice chap. He was a very kindly man.
Yes.
And, as you say, a very nice-looking man.
Yes.
Distinguished-looking man. But he lacked any sense of humor. The things he said to Dunlop and me, we couldn't believe that anybody could say them. He didn't see anything funny in them at all.
Well, he must have caused the pair of you a great deal of amusement, I think.
Well, it didn't really worry us, because when we knew he wasn't going to do anything, we just did it. He didn't mind not doing it, you know.
It was a successful book, and just leaving aside the question of books, you've met a number of noble lords and important people in medicine. Lord Horder, Lord Moran, and
yes, well, you, it,
Lord
it may,
Dawson.
It may be difficult for you to understand how I was personal friends with people who were 25 years older than myself. It really was rather like these whiz kids you talk about. The whole of the people in London, I was a fellow of their college, were all talking about Aberdeen with its new medical school, which was the envy of every university in Britain. And it had also the amount of good research that was coming out was terrific. And so that they were always writing me to come down and go round these full-time medical units that were run by the MRC to do ward rounds and give clinics. I was in London every fortnight because I was the chairman of the Empire Rheumatism Research Council. And every fortnight I went to one or other of the teaching hospitals and gave a ward round or a clinic or a lecture. And I got to know all these people in the college because they used to come up and have a look and talk to who's this young man who's doing all this, you see. And Lord Dawson was particularly kind to me. He was president of the college in those days, about 40 years ago. And all I need to say about him, he was like the old chap at Cambridge. He was the perfect gentleman. Never lost his temper, as suave as anything, as honest to the last word. You could trust him with anything you liked. He was so good. And the fellows trusted him so that he was president for about 7 years running, you know. And he was excellent with the royal family. They had awful troubles after he died. But during his period as physician, he was completely trusted by the royal family, and he always brought the right type in to see them when there was anything special to be done. And so everybody adored him, and I couldn't say enough for him. Now, his great rival, who spent his whole life trying to become president of the College of Physicians of London and failed always, was Horder. Now, Horder was entirely different. I knew Horder much better still. He stayed with me at least a dozen times, both in Edinburgh and in Aberdeen, as my guest when he came up examining or lecturing. And he was the president, and I was the chairman who did the damn work of the Empire Rheumatism Council, raised the money, and ran all the research and the distribution of the money. Horder used to like getting the limelight for doing it. But my principal objection to Horder was, first, he was totally untrustworthy, and he was the meanest man in Britain. When I tell you that he stayed with us dozens of times, that whenever I went to London, and that was once a fortnight, and I had to see him on business about the Empire Rheumatism Council, when we had to have a meal, I always had to pay for the dinner or the lunch and the drinks in London. Can you believe that? I don't know anybody who will believe it, but he was one of these chaps who never paid for a thing. He was amusing, but he never expected to pay, never did pay. I never got a meal out of him in 10 years. But worse still, he was an awful twister. Now, I must tell you a most extraordinary story, which I wouldn't tell you if it wasn't me, it's private. I've been a lifelong member, and I am a lifelong member of the Murray Golf Club in Lossiemouth. And when Ramsay MacDonald, who is the illegitimate son of a lady in Lossiemouth, was Prime Minister, some of my county friends blackballed him for the club for which he had put up for the Murray Golf Club. This was the most shameful thing I ever heard of in my life, to blackball the Prime Minister because he was a Labour man. And I was so enraged that I immediately took a car and went down to the fishing village where he had a house, and called on him and said, I must apologize for this scandalous behavior, and all I can do is to offer to drive you to Spey Bay and play golf with you there myself. And that's how I got to know him. And I used to take him regularly. He couldn't play golf. He was suffering from advanced glaucoma. He couldn't get his golf club within that of the border. But he told me the most remarkable stories about things that I've ever heard. He was a very good-looking man. He was a very well-dressed man. He was the vainest man I ever met. He loved duchesses and titled people. He was the best-read man I ever met. He loved good books, classical Scotch, and he couldn't help buying them. He didn't get them from libraries. Sir Alexander Grant, who was the baker who started McVitie and Price's, gave him $2,000 a year allowance while he was Prime Minister, and he spent it all on cigars as long as that and books. An extraordinary mixture, man. However, he asked me if I knew Horder, and I said, yes, I know him very well. I didn't say more than that, because by this time I was getting very fed up with Horder never giving me a drink. And he said, well, you know, Horder comes to my house every Friday morning for breakfast. And I said, what's he do that for? Well, he said, I've got glaucoma, and the excuse is he wants to see how my sight is getting on, as if he could do anything about glaucoma. And then Ramsay went on and said, that's what he says, but I see through him. What he's trying to get out of me every day, every Friday, month after month, is to make him appear. And I've resisted it for months. Every day starts on off, don't you think you should put me up for appearance? And Ramsay said, I kept putting off. I saw him through. Finally, he wore me down. And in order to get rid of him, he said, I got him a peerage, and then I knew he'd never bother with me again, and he never came back. Now, that's a true story. Now, isn't that a terrible story? Well, the other man that I wanted to tell you an even more extraordinary story was Lord Moran. He's now 90-something. He was a president of the college for years, and Horder had battled with him for years to try and put him out to become president. They wouldn't have him. Too many people in the college knew what I'm telling you about Horder. They didn't like Moran. Moran was called Sir Charles Wilson. He was known as Corkscrew Charlie. And his name, claim to fame was by a most wonderful piece of bribery. He was in St. Mary's Hospital, which was absolutely unknown to anybody in those days, when Corkscrew Charlie became the dean. What he did was he went up to Oxford and Cambridge and apparently openly gave scholarships to anybody who was a blue who'd come to St. Mary's. And from being completely unknown, within about 3 years, St. Mary's beat everybody at rugby and cricket and everything. And Corkscrew Charlie was right on the map. Well, then he did jolly well with Winston Churchill. He didn't really treat Winston. He was too wise. He wasn't much of a doctor, but he knew enough who to get in. And he was very good. He travelled with Winston all round the world when he was not a fit man. And I think he thoroughly deserved being made a peer by Winston for his years of services. But I had a frightful row with him, too, which lasted only one day. The government sent Lord Moran and me to France in the closing weeks of the war to address medical officers in France, Holland, Belgium, and Germany what we were going to rehabilitate them with postgraduate education. Now, the difference between Moran and me is that I'd spent my life in education and in postgraduate education, and I had taken endless trouble before we went to France to make visits to these different cities and in Edinburgh to start the postgraduate medical school to be ready for them. Moran had done nothing except speak. So when we went there, he opened the meeting. They brought in hundreds of these doctors in lorries and buses, and we all sat down, and then he got up and made an excellent speech about nothing, because he couldn't report about anything, because nothing had been arranged. And then he sat down at the end of the meeting. So when we went home to the hotel, I said, I want to have a private talk to you, Lord Moran. And I said, you know, I've not been invited to go to France by you. I've been invited to go to France by the government to represent Scottish medical interests, because such a large number of doctors are trained in Scotland. And I've arranged a great deal for them to come back to. Well, you haven't. And I've got to tell them what I've done. That's what I've come for. So I want you to get up as soon as you've finished and say that Sir Stanley Davidson is now going to tell you what's going to be done in Scotland. Oh, he said, I'm going to do nothing of the kind. Well, I said, I can just tell you what's going to happen if you don't do it. I just get up on my own and tell them I'm now going to tell you what we're going to do in Scotland. So you either ask me to, or I do it without being asked. Oh, he was furious. The next day he came back and he said, well, I've thought it all over and I think it's quite reasonable. I said, I think it is reasonable, because I've got something to say to what we've done and you've got nothing to tell them. So after that was settled, we went on touring through these countries together and got great friends. And he's still alive. He's 95 or something, but he's still alive. And I liked him very much in the end.
Well, thank you very much,
Mr. Stanley.
And there we are.